Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Monday, July 27th, 2026, and this is our Startups Edition.
Today's central thesis is that the era of scalable software-only growth is being replaced by the structural demands of physical integration. We are seeing a fundamental pivot from the lightweight, asset-light models of the last decade toward a high-stakes requirement for tangible, hardware-aligned infrastructure.
It's no longer enough to just write the code.
The focus is shifting toward the foundational layers of the ecosystem.
Let's start by looking at the core of the enterprise, founder foundations, specifically how scaling culture, branding, and relationships must evolve to meet this new complexity. 65%. That is the failure rate for startups when the issue isn't the product, the market, or the burn rate, but simply the people sitting around the same table. Today, we're looking at the human element of scaling. The messy intersection of co-founder friction, the rise of the founder as influencer, and the culture shifts that happen when a garage operation tries to become a corporation.
It is a massive statistical overhang. If you look at the data from Noam Wasserman, the people problem is actually the primary killer of early-stage ventures, often because founders fail to manage the relational intelligence required to survive the transition from a small, high-trust group to a larger, more complex organization.
It sounds like the startup version of a messy divorce. Only instead of splitting up the silverware, you're arguing over who owns the intellectual property and which Slack channel gets deleted.
There's a signal here, the stakes are even higher because, as Esther Perel points out, the way co-founders handle the endings of their previous business ventures, the unresolved grief or the resentment from a failed pivot or a broken partnership, directly dictates how they navigate power and trust in their current one. If you haven't processed the divorce of your last company, you're essentially bringing an invisible, highly volatile partner into your new boardroom.
So you're essentially carrying around the ghosts of your failed pivots to haunt your next Series A. That's a heavy way to start a Monday.
But there is a way to mitigate that through what Amjad Masud calls building in public. He argues that for a founder, storytelling isn't just a marketing perk, it's a vital prerequisite for company building. You have to communicate a vision that is significantly larger than the current headcount or the current revenue to successfully navigate those early, high-stress periods of fundraising and recruitment.
Right, because if you only talk about what you've actually achieved, you're just a person with a small, struggling business. You need the vision to bridge the gap between the reality of a basement office and the dream of global dominance.
And Masud suggests that the most efficient way to develop that voice is through a progressive overload strategy. He advocates for turning internal company updates, the stuff you're already writing for employees or investors, into public posts. It's essentially using your internal communication as reps in a gym. You practice the high-stakes communication in a lower-stakes environment where the company is still small, so that by the time you hit massive scale, the muscle memory for public leadership is already there.
It's like training for a marathon by running around the block, but the block is Twitter and everyone is watching you trip over your own shoelaces.
Which is actually a risk worth taking, according to Masud. He notes that the most effective way to handle a PR crisis, like the 2025 database error Replit experienced, is to simply own the mistake rather than being defensive. He observes that the people who actually get canceled are the ones who stop participating in the conversation entirely. If you maintain transparency and prioritize ownership of technical or operational failures, you can actually transform a crisis into a moment of brand reinforcement.
It's a bold move. Yes, we broke the database. Here is exactly how we broke it, and please don't leave us. It's the antithesis of the polished corporate PR machine.
And that shift is happening across the board. We are seeing a move toward unfiltered executive communication, where leaders like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg bypass traditional PR filters to engage directly with their audience. There is a growing public craving for unmediated truth, and founders who can leverage that authenticity can effectively bypass traditional journalistic bias.
It's essentially replacing a professional spokesperson with a direct line to a person who might tweet something at 3:00 a.m. It's certainly more efficient, even if it is a bit more chaotic.
It's a structural shift in how influence is distributed. But as you scale that influence, you run into the pirate-to-navy transition. As noted on the A16Z show, the aggressive winner-take-all tactics that work when you're a small player trying to disrupt incumbents, like Uber's infamous program to recruit Lyft drivers, become massive legal and reputational liabilities once you achieve market dominance and become the incumbent yourself.
So the very thing that makes you a winner makes you a target. You go from being the scrappy underdog to the big bad corporation just by succeeding.
Stepping back, this transition is complicated by the fact that your culture is being rewritten by new technologies. Masters of Scale has highlighted that AI is not just another tool for the IT department to manage. It is a structural shift in corporate architecture. CEOs now have to master token capital as fundamentally as they manage human capital. It's no longer just about managing people. It's about managing the computational and data-driven workflows that are reshaping the company's very foundation.
So the CEO's job is evolving from people person to orchestrator of human and silicon intelligence.
And that requires a new type of skill. We're seeing the emergence of what is being called cognitive coverage, where as we move from human-led tasks to agentic workflows, humans have to actively learn from AI actions to maintain a deductive understanding of what the agent is actually doing. You can't just outsource the thinking, you have to be able to audit the logic.
Because if you don't, you're just a passenger in your own company.
And the risk of losing that oversight is huge. There is a one-way door risk where proprietary tacit knowledge, that unique judgment and taste that lives in your employees' heads, can be inadvertently leaked into the public domain through unmanaged AI interactions and training trajectories. If your team is using unmonitored AI to solve problems, you might be accidentally training your future competitors.
It's like having a brilliant strategist who slowly leaks all the company's secret plays to the press every time they ask for a summary of the meeting.
It's even more pervasive than that. As discussed on the Tim Ferriss Show, the digitization of dark information, using AI to bridge the gap between unrecorded, real-world interactions and searchable data, could eventually create a new class of reputation report cards. These could audit personal behavior against stated values, meaning a founder's private actions could eventually be mapped against their public building and public persona.
So the building and public strategy comes with a massive, permanent audit trail. There's no such thing as a private mistake anymore.
Not if it leaves a digital footprint. However, there is a way to survive these shifts if you focus on the right things. The key is distinguishing the hedgehog from the hedgehog home, a concept from Masters of Scale. Your hedgehog is your core capacity and work, the thing you are uniquely good at. Your hedgehog home is the specific title, the organization, or the platform. Career longevity, and even company longevity, depends on your ability to migrate your hedgehog to new environments when your current home becomes unviable.
Don't get married to the company name, get married to the ability to solve the problem.
So here's the picture in the end. The most successful leaders will be those who act as problem solvers in chief. As the A16Z show has noted regarding Travis Kalanick's philosophy, management capacity is ultimately defined by the ability to scale problem solving. You treat your organizational structure as a way to expand the scope of solvable challenges. If the technology or the market changes, you don't change your identity, you just change the scale of the problem you're tackling.
Founders need to stop worrying about protecting the walls of their castle and start focusing on how to build better engines for the next fight.
It's about building a system that survives the person.
Investors should look for founders who treat their public communication as a training ground rather than a polished veneer.
We'll be watching for the first major instance of a token capital bankruptcy, where a company's mismanagement of AI workflows leads to a total loss of proprietary edge.
But if software is becoming more about the logic of the machine, how do we handle the moment that intelligence finally meets the physical world? I don't know, Alex. This whole physical AI hype feels like we're just taking the same hallucinating chatbots and giving them much more expensive, much more dangerous bodies. We're moving from software that can fail to write a poem to software that can accidentally crush a construction site.
I think you're underestimating the fundamental shift in the architecture here. We aren't just talking about putting a brain in a robot. We're talking about the transition from bits to atoms, where the goal is to treat physical industry like a computer.
Moving from bits to atoms. That sounds like a very expensive way of saying we're building more expensive robots.
It's deeper than that. Travis Kalanick, in his recent discussions regarding his venture Atoms, is essentially proposing an Atoms-based computer framework. He's arguing that we can model manufacturing as the CPU, real estate as storage, and logistics as the network moving packets, except the packets are actual goods.
So instead of a digital packet, I get a package that might be dropped on my porch by a box on wheels.
We can trace that further. The economic driver is a massive reduction in distribution costs. He envisions the internet food court model, where the convergence of automated food production, localized warehouse real estate, and autonomous delivery couriers could drop the cost of a professional meal from a $12 delivery fee to under a dollar.
Okay, but let's talk about the no-entry mind vision. He calls it removing humans from dangerous environments, which is a lovely euphemism for replacing high-risk jobs with high-capital hardware.
But the labor deficit is already there, Maya. As noted on the A16Z show, the primary driver for autonomous trucking isn't just tech superiority. It's a profound labor shortage caused by the health risks of the profession, like increased rates of melanoma and cardiovascular disease. Automation here isn't just about efficiency. It's about solving an existential safety risk in places like the Amazonian iron or mines Kalanick is targeting.
Even if you solve the labor part, you still have the legacy problem. You can't just download an update onto a 30-year-old hydraulic drill.
That's the massive engineering hurdle. To achieve autonomy in legacy heavy machinery, you have to bridge the gap between digital commands and non-native, non-drive-by-wire mechanical systems using physical actuators. It's why the real opportunity isn't in humanoid robots that can fold laundry, but in specialized wheel-based industrial automation, things like road graders or dust suppression bots.
It sounds like a massive capital sink. You're talking about massive hardware deployments that require muscular organizational structure.
Two things stand out. Scaling this requires protein, the infrastructure and stability to manage these massive fleets. And the software is actually getting more sophisticated to handle the chaos. We're moving away from imitation learning, where a robot just tries to mimic a human, toward end-to-end reinforcement learning in closed loops. The system uses synthetic data to identify its own errors and self-correct.
So the robot teaches itself how not to crash.
In a sense, yes. This relies heavily on world models, simulations that are so high fidelity and reactive that they perfectly align with real-world physics. This allows for training in a virtual environment that is indistinguishable from the physical one.
I still see a massive bottleneck. Digital AI has the entire internet to read. Physical AI has what? A few sensors in a mine in Brazil.
That's the mode. The data scarcity in physical AI is intense because you need proprietary, geographically restricted real-world data. This is why companies like Applied Intuition are building platforms like Dana to democratize this. They want to turn the complex, alchemistic task of robotics engineering into an agentic workflow that is as easy for a developer as building an iPhone app.
So we're heading toward a world of low-value autonomous bots for everything from leaf picking to, well, you get the idea.
Kalanick actually suggests this could trigger a Jevons paradox. As the cost of core goods like food and minerals drops due to this automation, the resulting surplus of capital and consumer demand could drive prosperity into entirely new, currently unknown human service categories.
Investors in heavy industry need to start looking at the integration of sensors and actuators rather than just the software layer.
Watch for the first major driver-out milestone in a commercial mining fleet. If they can prove a sustained increase in machine per hour output without a single human in the pit, the capital will flood in.
But if we can automate the physical world so easily, does the battle for control just move back to the code itself, specifically between the giants and the open source community? Less than 3%. That is the current penetration of AI in the global economy, which is a fancy way of saying we are currently living through the pre-internet era of intelligence, where the playing field is almost entirely empty.
It means we're in the middle of a massive structural shift, Maya, where the battle for dominance isn't just about who has the biggest model, but whether the future belongs to closed-door frontier labs or a decentralized ecosystem of open-weight models.
It's basically a high-stakes game of keep away between OpenAI and anyone with a decent GPU cluster.
The data tells a story. The stakes are moving from pure intelligence to how that intelligence is rooted. On the A16Z show, Ben Horowitz argued that the push to restrict open-source AI is less about genuine safety and more about a safety cloak for anti-competitive interests, essentially a way for dominant labs to establish a monopoly-style control over the ecosystem.
Safety is the new we just want to make sure no one else can compete with our margins.
That's the cynical take, but the mechanics support it. The A16Z show noted that large proprietary labs are bypassing the platform generation of business development to go straight to a monoculture generation, using a strategy similar to Microsoft's historical playbook to aggressively move into and subsidize their own application categories. They aren't just building the engine, they are trying to own the entire car, the road, and the gas station.
It's the classic way to ensure that if you're a startup, you're either a customer or a casualty. It's like being told you can use the highway, but only if you use our specific brand of tires, our specific toll booth, and our specific GPS that happens to redirect you away from any competing restaurants.
But the moat is evaporating. Sriram Krishnan pointed out that as open-weight models like Kimi K3, QN, and Grok build approach state-of-the-art performance, they are driving value toward infrastructure providers and neo-clouds. This forces frontier labs to lower token prices, which eventually erodes their gross margins.
So the godlike AI becomes a utility like water or electricity.
Something to flag here, we are moving toward a model routing paradigm. Instead of one massive, expensive API call to a flagship model, systems like Lovable are using routers to direct queries to the most efficient model available for the task. The A16Z show highlighted a 2025 Stanford study showing that 70% of common ChatGPT queries could be handled more efficiently by local models. This effectively dismantles the Einstein paradigm, where you use a supercomputer to solve a middle school math problem.
It's the end of the era of paying for prestige. We're going to see a world where your smart fridge uses a tiny, hyper-niche model for grocery lists, your laptop handles your emails with a local model to keep things private, and you only call in the superintelligent models when you're literally trying to solve fusion energy.
And that is where the real startup opportunity lies. The A16Z show suggested that the future of competitive advantage is the hill-climbing machine, where the IP isn't the raw model, but the proprietary loop of specific data, objectives, and reward evaluations used to train it. As claimant DeLang of Hugging Face noted, open source is the engine of the ecosystem, providing the specialized, localized intelligence that proprietary APIs physically cannot replicate, especially in airplane mode or offline environments.
So the frontier labs provide the heavy lifting, but the open source crowd provides the specialized muscles.
Right. The economic value will be bifurcated. We'll see a market where enterprises pay an 8x to 10x premium for superintelligent models for high-value roles like researchers, while using cheap, fast, open-weight models for low-margin administrative tasks. The real risk isn't even sleeper agent models from China. As the A16Z show argued, the real domestic threat is a single company monopoly that can unilaterally cut off or overcharge the entire application layer.
Founders need to stop building on top of a single, centralized brain and start building for the router. Watch for the next major moat-breaking release from the QN or Grok families that brings frontier-level reasoning to a much lower price point. But if we can decentralize the intelligence, we still have to figure out how to power the massive data centers running it all.
I was looking at the latest CapEx projections for the hyperscalers this morning, and it's becoming clear that the real AI war isn't being fought in model parameters anymore, but in the physical layers of the power grid and custom silicon.
The era of bigger is better for LLMs is being replaced by whoever has the biggest transformer and the most copper wiring wins.
Pretty much. We're moving from a software race to a massive infrastructure bottleneck. If you look at the US, the constraint isn't even the cost of electricity. It's the physical difficulty of grid interconnection and finding specialized electrical labor. We're seeing a massive gap where expensive hardware from Meta or Google is essentially sitting idle because the local voltage conversion isn't ready.
That sounds like a nightmare for any startup trying to lease compute. You can have the most efficient code in the world, but if the plug isn't in the wall, you're just running a very expensive space heater.
The pattern is clear, the workaround is getting wild. The A16Z show noted that some providers are now using mobile chillers and external generators to bypass the grid entirely. It's incredibly expensive, but if it reduces a deployment timeline by just 3 months, the massive economic value of getting those high-end chips training sooner justifies the extra spend.
It's the ultimate pay to skip the line strategy. But does this actually break NVIDIA's grip? I thought the whole point of the last 2 years was that everyone was scrambling to get as many H100s as possible.
The concentration is insane. Roughly 30% of all chips are flowing to just two companies, OpenAI and Anthropic, via providers like CoreWeave and Microsoft. But NVIDIA is evolving. They aren't just a chip vendor anymore. They are becoming a full-stack data center architect, integrating networking, CUDA software, and rack-level hardware to create a defensive moat.
So they're trying to own the entire room, not just the light bulb. But what about the custom silicon everyone keeps talking about? If Google and Amazon are building their own chips, doesn't that eventually erode that moat?
That's the primary existential threat. Hyperscalers are using their in-house supply chains to execute a margin compression exercise. They can use custom silicon like Google's TPUs for workloads that don't need peak NVIDIA performance. However, for a startup, there is a massive tech tree trap. To actually compete with NVIDIA's ecosystem, a new hardware entrant can't just be slightly better. They have to achieve a five-fold leap in efficiency just to offset NVIDIA's ability to out-execute on even slightly inferior hardware.
So unless you're a scientific miracle, you're basically just a 50% improvement on a much more expensive product. That sounds like a death sentence for hardware venture capital.
and it gets harder because of the design cycle catch-22. The A16Z show highlighted that hardware optimized for today's transformer architectures risks becoming obsolete before it even ships, because researchers are already shifting toward much more efficient matrix multiplication patterns. You could spend 4 years designing a chip only to find out the math it was built for is no longer the industry standard.
Which is a bit of a luxury for Intel, I suppose.
Far from it. The A16Z show pointed out that Intel's real threat is operational inefficiency. Their design-a-chip cycle can take 5 to 6 years, with up to 14 iterations per chip, compared to the industry standard of 1 to 3. They simply can't iterate as fast as the software is changing.
It sounds like the winners aren't the ones with the smartest models, but the ones who can manage the logistics of power, silicon, and supply chains.
The implication runs deeper. It's a game of physical engineering now.
Infrastructure investors need to stop looking at model benchmarks and start looking at gas turbine backlogs and transformer availability. Keep an eye on whether Google starts selling its TPU capacity to third parties, because that would signal the true start of the open standard era. But all of this physical consolidation makes you wonder how much of this is actually a trade war in disguise. If you want to kill a startup, you don't need a competitor, you just need a well-meaning regulator with a safety checklist.
That's a bit extreme, Maya, but the mechanics of regulatory capture are definitely real. We're seeing a shift where established players actually invite government oversight, because a predictable, high-barrier regulatory environment favors their massive compliance budgets over lean, agile teams.
So the giants are essentially asking for a moat made of paperwork.
It's a telling detail. And it's not just about US-China competition through direct chip bans. It's about bankshot diplomacy, using indirect tools like export controls to exert pressure. As the A16Z show noted, China is essentially using a commoditization of the complement strategy, releasing massive, high-quality open-source models for free to drive global ecosystem dependency on their hardware.
So while we're busy building walls around our frontier models, they're just handing out the blueprints for free.
It creates a massive strategic vulnerability. If American security professionals find our domestic models too restrictive due to heavy safety guardrails, they might bypass them for high-performing Chinese openweight models like Kimi K3. We're also seeing a massive imbalance in model distillation. Chinese models can leverage American reasoning traces for training, but American startups face a legal minefield if they try to use Chinese models as teachers for fine-tuning.
It sounds like we're trying to win a race by slowing down our own cars to make sure they're safe for the track.
It's even more granular. Look at the algorithmic discrimination laws emerging in Colorado and California. They create a liability loop where developers are held responsible for the disparate impact of an output, even if it's factually accurate. To avoid lawsuits, you're forced to add a DEI layer that can actually distort information.
Investors need to stop looking for the next safe model and start looking for the ones that can survive a fragmented regulatory patchwork. Watch for any movement toward a unified federal AI standard, because if we stay stuck in a 50-state compliance trap, we won't have a national market left to defend. As we wrap up this edition, it's clear that the thread pulling through everything we've discussed today, from the interpersonal friction that sinks 65% of ventures to the massive capital sinks of the new energy grid, is the end of the frictionless era. We are moving out of a period where scaling was merely about managing code and headcount, and into a period where growth is tethered to the heavy, expensive, and unyielding realities of hardware and power.
The single most critical shift is happening for the Series A founder. Your primary operational challenge is no longer just finding product-market fit in a digital vacuum. It is the sudden requirement to manage a dual-stack organization. You aren't just orchestrating human talent. You are now an architect of silicon and physical logistics. If you're building in the realm of embodied AI or automated industry, your ability to secure physical supply chains, the chips, the energy, the raw materials, is now just as vital to your survival as your ability to write clean code or build a cohesive culture. The margin for error has shrunk because you can't patch a broken power grid or a shortage of H100s with a software update.
It's a much more complex game of orchestration.
It really is. And if you want to see if this thesis of hardware-centric scaling is truly taking hold, keep a close eye on the next quarterly earnings from CoreWeave or NVIDIA. Specifically, watch for any significant divergence between their software-driven revenue growth and their physical capacity constraints. If they start signaling that the bottleneck has officially shifted from demand for intelligence to availability of atoms, then we know the transition from bits to atoms is officially complete.
Thanks for joining us for this week's deep dive. We'll see you next Monday.